following is an unrehearsed interview by John Klee with Mr. Carlisle Bezuden for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview is being conducted at Mr. Bezuden's home on January 19, 1988. I usually start these to ask you, tell me about your background. I'm particularly interested in the time that you spent and are still spending on publicizing tobacco and tobacco issues and news stories. How did you get into that business?
Well, I guess in the main part of it, you want to, of course, I've been farming since 1957.
Okay.
And raising,
you were raised on?
Raising tobacco.
Raised by a farm family?
Yes.
Tell me about that background. I guess you raised burley tobacco in this
area.
Well,
tobacco and sheep and cattle hay.
And then, what your father did most of his life?
Uh-huh.
He was a farmer.
Mm-hmm. And then I went to the news, worked at the newspaper as farm editor at the Lexington Herald Leader in Lexington, Kentucky. '69, I guess. And worked there for about 17 years, 16 and a half or 17. And reported all the farm news, in particular tobacco, because that is the big crop in central Kentucky.
Right. Now, you had what kind of background before that time? You had farmed a little bit before you went to the paper? Or
oh, yes.
College?
I farmed from 57 to 69. Of course, still farmed when I was at the paper,
sure.
But I mean, it was mostly full time.
Right.
I worked part-time jobs with soil conservation. With a fertilizer company and a seed corn company.
Mm-hmm.
So,
got a broad background there.
Yeah.
In reference to those tobacco issues, I want to go over, and you were writing for the paper during some, changing times,
mm-hmm.
and dealt with a lot of different people. That's the bulk of the interview. That's what I want to go to. In those early years, of course, we had we went from acreage to poundage.
Mm-hmm.
What was the atmosphere there? Were there people that were opposed to that, people supported it?
I think any time you have something new come up in a program that farmers have been involved in most of their life, you're going to have some, not necessarily opposition, but hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
They know what they've had has been working, and at least they're used to it, and they never know what the future might hold, so they're,
mm-hmm.
they're hesitant to change any type of anything in the main tobacco program. But
right.
I'm sure everyone now sees that it was the right thing to
mm-hmm.
change from acreage to poundage, because it controls the supply so much better.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing those articles, what kind of, who were you orienting the articles toward? Were you wanting to inform people that didn't know anything about tobacco? Were you most interested in trying to tell tobacco farmers or any farmer what was going on?
Well, you tried to write the articles as simple as possible so that people that were interested in it that didn't know about tobacco would understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things got pretty complicated trying to explain, but through numerous stories,
mm-hmm.
I would try to use maybe a little different approach each time to
mm-hmm.
so that one group might pick up on one type of story and another group pick up on another.
I see. How did you get selected by the Herald? Because you were a young man.
Farmer.
It's not like right out of college or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
I never really knew for sure. At the time I was working, I'd been working part-time, and the money that was involved in the part-time work dried up or was no longer available, so
right.
I was really out of a part-time job, and I was sort of half-heartedly looking for another part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to be in the house at the right or wrong time, whichever way you want to look at it, when the telephone rang,
uh-huh.
and it was a man from the newspaper, and said he had understood that I might be interested in getting another job,
mm-hmm.
and that I didn't have to have any training in the newspaper field,
mm-hmm.
and that they would train me themselves, And as it worked out, it never got around to where they did furnish someone to help train me, so it was sort of a self-learning experience, you know.
Who were you working with then? Who were the people that you were working with on the Herald staff?
Oh, I took the place of John Jenks, who was a long-time farm editor at the newspaper. He had died, I think, within a couple of years of that, and then they had two or three people in between that weren't farm-oriented and really didn't know about farming and whatnot. So I guess they just thought, since I would know more about farming and knew farm people, that it might work out. And like I say, it worked for 17 years.
Right. Who were the editors at the time you started, though? Do you remember?
Fred Wachs was the main, I guess he was the publisher at that time.
Right.
And he was a very, very nice man and knowledgeable about agriculture because he had a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And as time progressed, the newspaper was sold to Knight Ritter organization out of Miami, Florida.
That was just in recent
years. Yeah, in about the last, I guess, 7 or 8 years five or six years before I quit,
mm-hmm.
Retired. I took a early retirement from them because my dad was real ill and getting weaker all the time, and I wanted to spend more time with him. And and the new owners out of Miami didn't know what Burley Tobacco was, and we just didn't see eye to eye on what needed to be reported.
Right.
And
I want to get into some of the details of that.
So,
we'll just do it right now while you're talking about it. When you started in 69, of course, the health issue had already erupted in 64, I guess, with the
Yeah, but it wasn't very, it wasn't that that prevalent at that time.
That's
we just heard a little here, there, and yonder about it, but you didn't hear. I mean, you could go 6 months and not hear really anything about the issue.
Okay. Did you get any direction from your editors or the publisher about how to handle that? I mean, because
Mm-mm.
you were in kind of a sensitive.
Yeah. No. They just said report it like it is. And really, it really came to a forefront just about the time I left the paper, really, just the last 3 or 4 years that it's really been highlighted, so to speak.
Well, let me get right to one of the issues I wanted to ask you about, and that was, it seems to me, and of course I'm a regular reader of the Herald, and not only, not just picking on them, but it seemed to me like the state media, I don't know how to say it, of course, they've been very hard on the health issue mm-hmm. and saying, you know, farmers ought to find alternate crops and so
mm-hmm.
forth. And I wondered, you know, what kind of situation that put you in,
mm-hmm.
I mean, as a farmer yourself. And do you think the media, I guess the question is the media, do they have an accurate vision, or are they?
Well, I think on an issue like that, of course, I think the media, the community, maybe because there are fewer farmers all the time, want to read that type of information, because it's a negative. It's as far as farmers are concerned, at least it's a negative information, and it seems like the media plays up more negative type stories of any type than they do the others, and I've noticed just in the last 10 years that farm stories or farm-related information is getting less and less play up in the newspapers. It's more health or diet or mm-hmm. what's happening in Iran or something
sure.
like that.
Uh-huh.
And both the major newspapers now in Kentucky, the Courier Journal and the Lexington Herald Leader, do not have a farm editor. And as far as I know, do not have a designated farm writer.
I didn't realize that.
Or farm reporter.
Is that right?
I know the one at the Courier Journal left, I think in November, December, something like that, and went to work in Washington. And they haven't replaced him, and it's my understanding they won't. And the Lexington Herald's farm reporter that took my place left the 1st of January, and I understand that he's not being replaced.
I see.
So the farm news is just not getting out to the public now like it once did, because we're only what, 2.5 to 3% of the population now. Mm-hmm. And the local papers, the county papers, still, a majority of them still have good agricultural reporting. Mm-hmm. Our local paper, which is a daily, has a one full page a week.
Is that right?
And I know some other papers that I see around the county, the weeklies and the mm-hmm. and the dailies will have one page devoted a week, pretty much to agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is a question that's related to that. It seems to me, for example, I know the Herald Leader has told farmers, well, you need to get out of the tobacco business. And when they wrote such articles or editorials, did they confer with their farm editors, as far as you know, or when you were there, did they confer with
you? Well, they didn't start really doing that until after I left. Yeah, I've been gone about 2.5 years now, and this has just really all happened since then.
Uh-huh.
There, as far as I can see, there is no alternative to tobacco.
To
replace it, I mean.
At this,
As far as income is concerned. So
that was really a question I had. It seemed to me like some of the editorial writers really didn't have a firm grasp of what was going on in the state, and they were writing these articles without really a background.
Yeah, I've noticed they have a lot of statements, but no answers.
Right? I see. Okay. Let me take you back then and go through some of these years that you were involved in reporting the news and some of the changes that took place. One of the things that a lot of Kentuckians don't realize is that there's other kinds of tobacco than burley in this state. Did you have call to do much reporting on the dark tobacco or the
no
the fire cure,
because
the,
our paper didn't go that far in its
areas.
Distribution, so really there wasn't much. I would report a little on flue cured tobacco because it had a relationship in its programs and prices to burley.
Right.
Not a direct relationship, but if prices were up in the flue cured belt, which sold before we did, then 9 out of 10 times prices would be up in the burley when
right.
burley came to market later and things like that. So I did do a little with flue cured, but there's not, as far as I know, there's not any flue cured grown in Kentucky.
Just
the dark tobacco.
Minor programs. Something else that happened right after you started, and I'm asking the question, did anybody notice it much, or did you see it happening in your reporting, was the companies importing more in the 70s?
Oh, yes. They started importing a lot more tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that made the other countries start raising more because the companies were, and we slipped. The United States slipped from, I think, 65 or 70% of the world production of burley down to about 30% or maybe 29%. Just cut it right in half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but now it's turning around the other way.
Right. The information that you got, and that brings me to a question: the sources of your information. Was that obvious during the 70s?
It was of a great concern. A great concern to the tobacco leaders that more and more tobacco was coming into this country, being imported in, and there were several attempts made to limit that through legislation, but to of no avail. The companies had a lot more money to put in the lobbying efforts than the tobacco farmers,
right.
And they were more organized, of course, right. Naturally.
What happened, and this came, I guess, in the early 80s with the no net cost, was that, did you, from your viewpoint, was that a direct response to the health concerns, the fact that the program went to this no net cost?
I don't really think that was a direct, there were a lot of factors involved there, and I don't really think the health issue had a lot to do with it. It might have been a minor part or a contributor to it, but not the main part. It was just we needed a way to say that tobacco made its own way, and that we weren't asking for the taxpayers to pay anything on it. And this was a way that the farmers could support themselves, so to speak, through through this no-net cost. And that gave us a little more clout in Congress when they took a look at the budget to see how much money was going out to farm programs and this, that, and the other. And they couldn't really come up with a main issue against tobacco because there was money in a fund through that no-net cost to refund the government if it was going to be out any money. And so it made it made the program stronger.
Of course, the turnaround then occurred when there was a bad crop year and so forth. What was that like during that year as far as reporting the 83
crop?
Right.
Well, looks like there's a dilemma every year when you're reporting about tobacco. It's either a drought or it rained too much or something. There was something wrong with it. The companies wanted a different color of tobacco than we had that year, and if we grew that color the next year, they wanted the color we had the year before or something like that, you know. So, of course, the drought did hurt as far as income. It it was a major blow to tobacco farmers at that time, but they did or were able to recoup the next 2 years by growing that lost quota in later years.
Were you still reporting on the paper? I didn't write down the year when the 85 compromise came into being.
Yes, I was writing on the beginning of that.
Okay.
Fortunately, that's probably be one of my long memories of the tobacco business because I was had access to sit in on some of the early meetings that were just in the beginning of that program as being a reporter.
Right.
And it was through the open meeting laws and whatnot. I could I could go in and listen to them, and I had a good understanding with tobacco leaders. Rather than them going into closed session, which I would not be allowed in, they would ask me, could they have my word that what they said there would be off the record until a little later into the into the program, and and but for my help to allow me to sit in on those meetings and sort of being able to grasp what they were trying to arrive at and whatnot, so it was a big help. So we worked, and then they gave me early information to publish for that. Agreement between them, so I was able to scoop some of the other newspapers sometimes on some of the information coming out.
Tell me about those meetings. I understand that there was a meeting in Lexington of a bunch of tobacco leaders, maybe a local hotel or something, that where they talked out some of these things. Can you recall some of those? Who were the principals involved?
Oh, not really offhand. I could go back some of my notes that I've kept, and I don't know what I'll ever do with them, but I kept them anyway. Their Farm Bureau, of course, Ray Mackey was very instrumental in working with the program. Henry West, I think he's been involved with the tobacco, well, with the Council for Burley Tobacco and also the Tobacco Advisory Council. And Albert Clay at Mount Sterling was working with him at that time, a warehouse operator, and he was been a major leader in tobacco over over a number of years. And oh golly, there's others I'm sure I should name, but I just don't remember them.
What about the manufacturers? Were they just kind of of course, well, they were very important to the
yes,
what happened.
In the preliminary stages, they weren't at the meetings, but as a plan was worked out and then presented to the tobacco company leaders, then they were brought in to give their views and how they would accept what had been proposed, and then they began to work together. And it all worked out, I think, to the advantage of the farmer.
You feel pretty good about the process that
yes,
took place. And
I think the tobacco program was awfully close to going under at that time. It's hard to go back and tell now exactly what would have happened, but it was on the downhill drag, as we say in the farm circles.
What were some of the big hang-ups at that point? And the reason I'm asking that is because it probably highlights some of the differences between some of these groups.
Well, you had a lot of give and take. The farmers had to take a 30-cent cut in support prices.
Mm-hmm.
Was one of the major steps, and then the companies guaranteed to buy the 82 and 84 crop that were in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
So those were probably the two major steps, and then the companies. I don't think they really said they would limit their imports of burley tobacco, but it was sort of inferred there that if they were going to be buying more U.S. burley,
right,
that they would have to cut back. So it was just sort of an understanding that,
mm-hmm,
that they would cut back on imports, which was a big help.
I've interviewed Mr. Mackey, and let me ask you this question, because again, you've been kind of an official observer. It's kind of surprising to me that, and of course, he did take, I think, a leadership role from everything I can tell,
mm-hmm,
how farmers didn't take him to task as much as they have. I mean, farmers have really, they've taken cuts in allotment, they've taken cuts in their income,
mm-hmm,
and still seems to me, you know, to try to understand and go along with the program. Can you explain that? You know, the other groups would have been protesting and striking and so forth.
Well, I think farmers are probably the least organized group of people in the United States.
That's true.
And as an individual, they really just don't publicly complain too much. Now, they'll get around the country store,
sure,
a stove, and complain this, that, and the other, but they don't really write letters to Washington and this, that, and the other. So really there's only, that's why these tobacco groups are so important, because they are made up of the grassroots thoughts out in the country,
mm-hmm,
and then they try to relay these onto Washington, how farmers feel and this, that, and the other.
Yeah. I think I've hit most of the major issues that you probably faced during that time. Let me go back and talk about, well, first I want to ask you about your sources of information. Where did you get the raw material to go into your articles?
From the tobacco officials mostly. Of course, I had people that would tell me things that didn't want their name mentioned, so we had,
sure,
to use sources without a name sometimes,
mm-hmm,
which is not always good, because you need to focus a statement on a person,
mm-hmm,
but sometimes those people would tell you things that that they just didn't want their name associated with, because they would be reprimanded,
sure,
being an official or a high up in an organization,
mm-hmm,
and they were telling me sort of in-house secrets,
right,
so to speak, and uh-huh, and but people would call you on the phone, and of course I went to all the meetings and picked up on the different things that were being brought up,
right,
there, and would interview different ones.
It required probably a lot of night work.
Yes, actually, my hours were from 10 in the morning to about 7 at night on a normal basis.
Uh-huh.
When I first started, I knew I had to do my farming, and when I first started the paper, I think I went to work at 3 o'clock and got off at midnight. So, but that sort of worked around to where it,
right,
came back earlier in the day.
Can you remember any stories that maybe drew an awful lot of response, or maybe got you in trouble, or anything that made people mad?
Switching from hand-tied tobacco to bale tobacco. That was probably the hottest topic while I was working at the newspaper.
Uh-huh.
There was more controversy over that than anything.
Is that right? Do you remember some of that? Now, of course,
I've seen people walk out of the meetings. They got so upset over the over the thing.
Of course, the who had to decide that they would accept the bike in that form? When was that decided?
Well, it was initially had to be legislation put in that form, mm-hmm. but there were tobacco groups that wanted it that way. They saw a cut in cost for the farmer. And that he could do it much more, he could prepare his tobacco much more efficiently for the market, mm-hmm. and cheaper. But the companies fought it because they had been handling hand-tied tobacco, and their machinery was in the assembly lines or production lines were set up to handle it that way. Right. So they fought it tooth and nail, and we had some people in the tobacco groups that fought it because they didn't think it was a good thing, mm-hmm. and like I say, there was some very heated debate over that, probably more so than anything else I ever saw.
When you were writing those articles, of course you were reporting information when they made those decisions and mm-hmm. so forth. You didn't take any stand on that.
You couldn't. You had to report right. both sides. I would report in the same story the pros and the cons. I would quote people that were for it and quote the ones that were against it. You had to be fair on something like that.
Of course, you were farming in the evenings too. Which did you switch over pretty quickly?
Oh yes, the first year. Yeah.
You're not
personally. I was a believer in the bale tobacco because I could see that it would save money. Right. But some of the other people that had been in it much longer than I had and had hand tied tobacco, say for 50 years or something, it was very hard to convince them that it would be the right thing.
What about your relationship? We're talking about sources, information. The relationship with University of Kentucky. Did you have a pretty good relationship?
It was very good. Yes, uh-huh. yes. I had a lot of help from the university. Anytime I needed to know any facts and figures that I didn't have access to or quick access to, I could call some of the tobacco specialists and. An economist, an agronomist, and depending on what the subject might be, and they were very helpful. They went out of their way really to help.
Yeah, of course. There's been some changes over there, really quite a few in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. and I guess there's some more coming. The deans, going to be stepping down. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the individuals there that were particularly helpful?
Dr. Joe Smiley was probably the most helpful. And at one time, I guess in the early years, Ira Massey, who was in the tobacco department, mm-hmm. Dr. Stokes was a big help in a lot of information that I needed. Mm-hmm. He was in all the higher level tobacco meetings and whatnot. So.
Right.
Oh golly, there's been quite a few. I've forgotten some of the agronomists' names now that I used to talk to, but and not only on tobacco, but on any other subject that came up, livestock or mm-hmm. other crops. I never had any difficulty getting information from them.
That you mentioned other crops, and of course, those kinds of ideas have come and gone over the last, close to 30 years we're talking about now that you were with the paper, that time, stretching over that time mm-hmm. period. I guess you reported, I know recently now they're talking about hay and growing hay as mm-hmm. a cash crop. Mm-hmm. I guess you reported those kind of things dutifully, but...
Yes, but hay really had just come on the last couple
right,
of years.
Yeah.
There was beginning to be some talk about hay associations being formed just mm-hmm. about the time I left,
right.
and that's probably about as close to an alternative to tobacco, or at least a crop that will help build up the income that has been lost through tobacco.
Well, in the 70s, wasn't there a big urge to go big and tear down fences and try to grow corn and some of those kinds of things?
In other parts of the country, and I guess the closest was in Western Kentucky to us,
right.
But not around here too much. We didn't We're basically tobacco and cattle country.
Let me ask you about the plight of the farmer, and I guess I don't know how it is in this area, but there have been farmers, even though tobacco has held its own a little bit. I mean, we're not as bad a shape maybe as the Midwest.
No, not near.
That way, but there have been a lot of farmers, I guess, that have gone broke.
Yes, I think some through poor management and others have just they've held on as long as they could, and then when the high interest rates came up, it was just the straw that broke the camel's back.
What about the reduction in quota and price? Is that putting a lot of people close to the brink?
Or? Putting a lot of pressure on them, it really is, because you take over the last 5 or 6 years, we're raising just about half the tobacco that we used to raise.
This is side two of a tape with Mr. Carlisle Bazudin. We finished up talking about the pressure from the drop in quota and then the drop in price over the last few years. Let me move to a few other subjects I want to touch on with you. Of course, in that time period, it seems like I think farms have gotten bigger, farmers have gotten older. Is there some, I guess there's just not enough money made on the farms? What were some of the information?
Yeah, that's the main thing. We were talking at a farm meeting the other night. We looked around among ourselves, and we were all about 25 or 27 when this particular group was formed, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're all the 50 to 55 or 60 years old. And there's no young people coming in. There's just no one around to take over. It takes so much money now to get geared up to farm.
Yeah.
You're talking about a small tractor at $15,000, and
right.
And if you have a farm of any size, you're talking about $30,000 to $40,000 to $45,000 for one machine, and that then you have to buy something for it to pull.
That's true. So
there's another $15,000 or so to put out for the machine that you're going to pull behind the tractor, and interest above 10%. I know we used to figure if we made 5 or 6% on the farm in a year, it was a good year.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're paying 10% and above for interest, you're minus 4 or 5% right there, and over a period of 20 years, works up to 100% real quick.
That's right. What about the related industries, the towns, the equipment dealers, the fertilizer companies? Again, you know, from your reporting and so forth, have you seen an impact there too?
I can remember when a small community like Winchester had four different tractor dealers in it, and we have one now. And I've heard them remark that if it wasn't for their repair business, that they would go out.
Yeah.
They're just not selling enough new machinery because the farmer can't afford it.
Right.
He just something breaks, he welds it or has it repaired or a piece replaced, and that's the only thing that's holding some of these machinery dealers in the community now.
Let me ask you. Of course, you're now working 2 days a week for the co-op.
Mm-hmm.
What are your responsibilities there?
Public relations, mostly. I put out a newsletter about every 2 or 3 weeks, depending on what's going on in the tobacco community. And we're trying to get out to the farmer or through the through the newspapers and radio what our role in the tobacco program is.
Mm-hmm.
And so people know more about what the co-op does. They just know tobacco goes to the pool, and they really don't, most of them don't realize what happens after
that.
They get paid for their crop, and that's it, you know, it's gone. But the pool is playing a more important role in the tobacco program now because the companies are required to buy so much tobacco. It can be purchased through the co-op or on the active market.
Mm-hmm.
And it still counts as part of their purchase. In other words, I think they guarantee the government that they'll buy 90% of what they say they're going to buy. They mm-hmm. they give them a figure every year,
right.
Because that goes along towards setting the quota for the
sure.
following year.
Yeah. So does that mean there's more reporting responsibilities for the co-op? They have to keep track of things a little closer?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And we're getting quite a bit of interest now from the companies. They're wanting a lot more samples, which they determines how much tobacco they'll want out of the pool or what type,
right.
what blend.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are really picking up. The cooperative is playing a lot more role in the Burley.
That's one of the things
program.
I wanted to talk to you about next. And one of the things that that people that aren't initiated don't know is that there are literally probably dozens of tobacco groups of one stripe or another,
mm-hmm.
and they all have different roles. And I want to kind of go down through the list and let you give me a reaction to what their role is and what kinds of things they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you think you know their activities have gone over the years. Farm Bureau, for example.
Farm Bureau is probably one of the two major tobacco groups.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm sure each group thinks it's a major group,
right.
but in my opinion, Farm Bureau is a major group. They're because they are the largest farm organization,
mm-hmm.
and so naturally they would play a large role in tobacco. And they have a very active president and tobacco committee that are committed to the tobacco program.
Mm-hmm.
So they're right on top of every little item that comes up about tobacco,
mm-hmm.
and they jump right on it. I guess probably the second of the top two would be the Council for Burley Tobacco,
right.
which is sort of an umbrella group of the entire industry, and so naturally it would play a large part. It
mm-hmm.
the companies are involved there, and the dealers, or the processors, the growers, and
yeah.
Just everyone. So those two probably are the major.
Yeah.
Two major groups.
Let me ask you about the warehousemen. How have they been pretty much a full partner or, in some of the changes? Or
yes, I think for the most part, there were some warehousemen that fought the change from hand tied to bale, of course,
mm-hmm.
because it would mean a different way of handling tobacco.
Right.
But most of them could see that there was going to be a savings even for the warehouse
yeah,
there, because they can handle
right.
it a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, they're a private industry. I mean, they're there for profit,
sure.
and
sure.
so they work a little different than say the Farm Bureau and the mm-hmm. Council for Burley Tobacco.
Right.
But they've been committed to as good a tobacco program as we can get, because it means money in their pocket,
sure.
the better the program is. So
program's gone, they could...
Yeah, yeah. So for the most part, they've been very cooperative. And
this is kind of just a related subject. I was in Cynthiana before Christmas, and someone, it was a warehouseman, in fact, that told me that a company was buying some tobacco privately. Have you seen very much of that go on? You know,
that's been done for over a number of years, but it's a very minor part of sales.
Mm-hmm.
That just isn't done much. There's been some talk that companies maybe would like to negotiate with a few big farmers in each county if the program went under,
right.
and have a collection point at maybe one of the larger warehouses in the community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pitfalls in that, and of course you would be taking a price that the company's set, and naturally
yeah,
they're going
right.
to set a price to where they can make money.
Right.
So it wouldn't be the best for the farmer to go to that route.
Yeah.
And most of them see that, so they won't even consider selling to a direct to a tobacco
right.
company.
Of course, there's some criticism of the auction system too. You know, particularly we've had some years, and I'm sure you recall them, where we had some one-price tobacco. And you know, of course, the thinking is by some farmers, well, these people, you know, they're just taking care of themselves, and you know, there's not really an auction going on. What what's the response to that?
I think most farmers realize it's more of an allotment type a sale than it is an actual auction. They have to go through the formality more or less because that's the law.
Right.
But it has a lot to do with allotment, and tobacco companies are hard to figure out. One year they'll buy everything at one price, which was a good price at that time. I think that was in '80, mm-hmm. if I remember right.
Well, there's been, several years, I think, where there's...
I knew people that swept their stripping room floors, and that included dirt and chewing gum wrappers and candy wrappers and everything.
They bought
at the very same price. This year, they said some of the tobacco was a little too yellow, and they shied away from it
and
wouldn't buy it. But it shows if there's a tobacco shortage, like there was a high demand and a shortage of tobacco like it was in '80, that they can use it.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But it's just like any other business. If you have more tobacco or more of anything than you want, naturally you're going to pick out the best
mm-hmm.
and let the other slide.
Right.
But if you're desperate for whatever they have, you're going to take it all.
Of course, I guess. It's hard to without. You'd have to just ask a manufacturer how they decide to go ahead and bid along with everybody else.
Kind of things. Of course, there's always talk of collusion,
mm-hmm.
but that's against the law, and I don't really think that happens. I think they're smart enough to know that there are only six major tobacco companies,
mm-hmm.
and in the United States, and they wait and see what maybe the major one or two companies are going to bid, and they just fall right in line. So
somebody sets the pace
because they know they're not going to buy all the tobacco.
Sure.
And why raise the price? Why outbid them mm-hmm. when you can save your company money by just waiting until one company fills their orders, and then you jump in at the same price
and get what you need
buy,
too,
yeah.
or most of what you need. A couple of other organizations that are involved here, of course, the co-op, and you've talked about it a little bit as your new employer, but you mentioned they're taking a more active role. The co-op's essential to the program. It's kind of the center of the program.
Well, of course, it takes all the tobacco that doesn't bring a cent above the price support.
Right.
And then we process it and put it into blends and store it. And then when the companies need an extra supply of tobacco in the middle of the year, when there's no tobacco on the market, then they can come to the co-op and order whatever they want. Of course, they're charged processing charges and storage charges and interest charges on the money borrowed to buy the tobacco, and they don't get it free.
Yeah. Of course, it's better, I guess, what you're saying there, if the manufacturer can plan it out well enough and know what he needs, he'll get off a little cheaper maybe by going ahead and buying it at the auction.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the advantage of the co-op for him is there's a ready supply there all
gives
the time.
Gives him a year-round supply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, usually we'll have at least four different crop years. And if they want a little darker, a redder tobacco, well, one of those 4 years mm-hmm. we'll have that type tobacco. If they need in their blends, if they say they need a little more of a certain type tobacco, then they can usually find it in one of those 4 or 5 years that we have on hand.
How do you all make your decisions, for example, about how you're going to blend your tobacco? I know you use I don't know what the term, for example, in maize would be Parker tobacco.
We have worked with the tobacco companies on what they think they will, the types of blends that they can use, and we'll put 4 or 5 grades of tobacco within the same leaf category
mm-hmm.
in a blend, and it's worked out with the company so that it's advantageous to them as well as us. We don't have to have separate the tobacco so much, so many different grades, because we have 102 grades, I believe, or three, something like that. And that would be pretty difficult to put each individual grade in a 900 pound hogshead and keep it all separated and whatnot.
Right.
So we have about there's probably 20 different blends that we put all this tobacco in.
And the co-op does all this kind of administratively. I mean, the actual doing of it is out at regional centers and so forth. How many people are you working with out in the state now?
Well, our cooperative at Lexington handles tobacco from 5 states, and then the Burley Stabilization Corporation in Knoxville, Tennessee, handles the pool tobacco from 3 states. And we have 5 processors for our co-op in Lexington that process this tobacco from us. And they're scattered over the state pretty much, so the tobacco, whichever tobacco is as close to that processor that he gets then.
In my region, up in Parker Tobacco would handle tobacco from Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And Northern Kentucky, Northern Kentucky. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we have one down in Bowling Green, and then I think 2 in Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
And also if one gets filled up, sometimes there's more tobacco going to the pool in a certain section of the state than the others. So if one processor gets filled up, then we will have to truck tobacco a little farther than we normally would to give it to another processor that's not getting too far behind.
And then this tobacco that's 1, 2, 3, 4 crop years, it's stored all over the place too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Warehouses.
But that's all kept on the books, and we can go to we can go to any warehouse and any row of hogs that's in that warehouse and know exactly where
a
tobacco's there, or to get a sample for it for a company or anything like that. It's quite a bookkeeping situation there.
Uh-huh. What about foreign buyers and foreign markets over the years? Of course, we said in the 70s they were importing into us, so I guess there was always a limited amount of us exporting because they want our tobacco, but what kinds of buyers have you seen come and go, and who's important now?
The foreign buyers like the very best quality tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently they have the money to buy it, because it seems like money is no no problem to them. They'll buy the very highest priced tobacco. Mm-hmm. And they buy through the dealers. We don't sell direct to any foreign buyers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We sell through a dealer in the United States. So.
Right.
The foreign purchasers would give their order to a dealer in our country.
Now, like Southwestern would be a dealer,
right.
And maybe the Japanese might be buying through them. Or the.
And then, of course, the American companies buy direct from the market for the foreign buyers also.
Right.
So,
well, now what kind of nationalities? Of course, the Germans and Japanese is who you hear quite frequently. What other foreign buyers?
The Chinese are coming in now pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably the only other major buyer.
Have there been any we've lost over the years?
No, not that I know of. Of course, I'm not really up to date on that aspect of the tobacco business, because that's through the buyers and whatnot. But none that I've heard about.
Okay. I want to talk about a few individuals, of course, that are that have been very prominent in tobacco, and let you give me a few of your impressions about them and your dealings with them. Mr. John Berry, that's from Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the older gentleman now. I think the younger gentleman, Mr.
is now president.
His
son.
Did you have very many dealings with him over the years, and what kind of individual was he as far as?
Not really. He was pretty much retired when I started working with the co-op 2 years ago.
Right.
But
I was thinking
he was been with them. He's been with them over the years, and I think been a very influential leader. He was president at one time, and more recent years, he was their counsel.
Legal counsel, right?
And so he did all the legal work and whatnot. So. But he's been involved in it probably for 40 years or more.
What about Ira Massey? You said you had some dealings with him.
Ira was was a great promoter of right. Burley Tobacco. I think he was a great adversary of the program and tried to promote Burley wherever he went. And he had a television program that he always had a Burley Tobacco official on mm-hmm. to give comments on Saturday. And
the reason I ask that, it seems to me like with his death, that kind of there was kind of a void.
Yeah.
There's no person that's kind of identified in the same way as he was.
Really, there's not. There's no one who's taken over his place. He had, like say, a television program, and they don't have that anymore.
And radio program.
He wrote
all over
radio
the place,
and wrote columns for farm magazines, and they really sort of like in the newspaper business, once a farm editor or reporter leaves or retires or dies or whatever, they don't replace him.
Let me ask you about a couple other trends that I've seen. And of course, when you, and I don't know how much contact you have here locally, it seems that at one time in this state there was a significant number of black farmers, and that number has dwindled some. Mm-hmm. Was that something that ever came to anybody's notice, or just kind of happened?
No, I don't really think so. I think it's sort of like any other race that there's just not any new ones coming on. When the older ones retired or died or got out of the business, just no one took their place. So we've probably had as great a percentage white farmers quit farming or not farming now as black or
just weren't as many blacks to begin with.
Yeah.
What about tenant farmers? It seems that again, that's another thing, that the rate of tenancy, there used to be, you know, little tenant houses dotted all over the place.
And now it's mostly it's going to farmers that are raising other people's crops. In my situation, the man that raises my crop raises for five other farmers down the road, and so he doesn't really have a farm of his own, but he raises cattle and tobacco on a 50-50 basis on a number of different farms. So it's coming more to that now than just the general, just the typical tenant farmer that we used to hear about.
Of course, there's a few people like that. I guess they're actually making a living off farming, but they have to do it by leasing numerous crops.
Mm-hmm. It has to be on a large
big operation.
It has to be on a large scale. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know numerous people that are raising 3, 4, 5, 6 crops at one time, and they just can't make it on the small farm anymore.
Yeah. You're writing press releases now, and I guess you're trying to. As you said, I guess it's kind of difficult, isn't it, if you don't have a person there at the local paper that is in charge of that, no farm editors or no farm reporters. How do you try to get the word out?
Well, fortunately, I knew enough people to talk to get the information I need without maybe calling the newspaper to find out what their reporter happened to be working on at that time.
Right.
Being maybe a little more directly involved in the tobacco business through the cooperative, mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll call the farm reporter and tell him what is happening so he can write a story on it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But we put the press releases out to all the daily and weekly newspapers in the tobacco communities.
Right.
And hopefully that they will print part or all of the mm-hmm. of the press releases. And,
right.
And also all the radio stations in the five states. So we have about, I have a mailing list of about 450 people, either reporters on newspapers, tobacco officials, radio stations, and whatnot. So we're trying to get the word out the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a person that's reporting for the cooperative, the word from the cooperative is we're in a pretty good situation. I let me make the question more direct. It seems to me to be hard to read whether things are good or bad. For example, where some of the markets are finishing up selling this week,
mm-hmm.
and 40% of the crops going to the pool, which
mm-hmm.
happens at the end of a selling season anyway. But it seems to me with reduced quotas, they're even talking about raising quota next year.
Yeah.
But that seems to be a contradiction if 40% is going to the pool and they're talking about raising quotas. Explain that.
Well, actually, even though more tobacco is going to the pool, we've sold a lot more out of the previous years from the pool. So actually, the overall pool supply is not increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And the companies this year have guaranteed the government that they will buy 24% more tobacco next year on the 88 crop, or this year, the 88 crop.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows the government to actually increase the quota to some extent. Now, I think we had a newspaper article the other day that said 6.5%. I think the final outcome on that will be closer to 3.5%, 3 to 3.5. So, and we, like I say, we've had upwards in the 40% in cuts the last 5 or 6 years. So,
does this mark kind of the turnaround, you think?
Yeah, I really do. I think this new program that began in '85 really didn't take effect, I guess, till the '86 crop. Time flies. Sometimes I miss it a year.
Yeah, right.
But the act actually came into effect in '85, and so it is turning around now.
Yeah.
Less imports, even though less tobacco is being used domestically, we're exporting substantially more tobacco through cigarettes or just general leaf to cigarette companies in foreign markets.
What about the politicians? The statesmen, maybe use that word, or, you know, the people over the years, as you've reported, have they, how do you see them as advocates for the farmers, people like McConnell and Ford and Huddleston and
I think, fortunately, in Kentucky and most of the other tobacco states, we've had real good legislatures that have really come out for tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been for them, I think the program would have gone by the wayside long before this, because there are a lot of opponents in other states that don't raise tobacco. They don't really probably understand the importance, and naturally it's not important to their state.
Sure.
And they see this money being loaned out to the cooperatives to purchase tobacco in the tobacco states. Well, they would like to get that money in their state, maybe to build roads or do something else that would get them elected next time.
That's true.
So our senators and representatives have just gone above and beyond the call of duty, really, to help the tobacco program.
Did you have occasion to have to call them about articles, or did they call you?
Yeah.
Or?
Definitely. I quoted several of them numerous times over what was happening in Washington, when, depending on the legislation that had to do with tobacco, when it got off the ground level, so to speak, here in the farm groups and got to Washington, then I would call them and ask their comments on how they felt about it, or how they voted. And naturally, there's always for the program.
Right.
But
in particular stick out in your mind that was particularly friendly or cooperative?
Congressman Hopkins probably was the most helpful. They would actually call me on occasion,
mm-hmm.
if I didn't know something was coming up for a vote a day earlier than maybe I thought or something, and
right.
they would call me and let me know that such and such had passed, or then I could get it in the paper that night. Usually it was about 30 minutes before I was to get off work when they called, and
right.
so I was there for another hour and a half or 2 hours
yeah.
writing the story.
Right. What about the farmers themselves? Have they let quality and so forth slip over the years? It's kind of a criticism I know the manufacturers often often make, and I know there's concerns at the co-op about that.
I think the majority of the farmers try to raise a good quality crop to begin with, but then they get it on the market and they're not paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of defeats the idea that the companies are always trying to install in the farmers to produce. We have to have quality tobacco to use or to sell overseas. And then, so the farmer tries to do that, and then when it goes to market, they pay the same amount if you mix it all up. And
right.
Personally, the tobacco, the crop we sold this year was all stripped in one grade, and sent to market, and they actually didn't even market a mixed grade.
It is
sold as a one grade tobacco, and got a good price for it. So. And that's not what the companies would tell you. They want it stripped in 2, 3, 4, 5 grades sometimes.
Yeah.
But they don't back it up at the marketplace. And of course, that's what the farmer is looking at.
Right. Well, I appreciate you talking to me.